Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour for March 8th, 2018. And main science topic tonight, I'll be talking about some aspects of the wing generator and some information that you may not have conjured up from other things that I presented on this. But first, a few main topics. I think I mentioned on a show before that I watched The Martian. Now, that's a movie I did not watch before because, I guess Hollywood. I just have this thing about Hollywood. But it turned out that I walked into a public area and they were showing the movie The Martians. It was kind of like they have these certain days where they show movies. And so I sat down and I watched, and I thought it was very good. I like it. I like Matt Damon movies. He's a good actor. I think he's a good person in real life also. But the whole show, it had a lot of twists and turns, of course, and how they had to pull out all the stops to save him. And, of course, at the end it was, nail-biting, because if they missed him, he'd go zipping off in space, never to return again. So there was a lot of good production in the, getting to the final cheer when he was saved and the whole world cheered, and the cooperation with the Chinese, even though it was their secret program and they had to open up and let everybody know, and all of the intrigue that went along with it. But the setting for The Martian took place, and as I understand, they did not film this on location, but the background, much of it came from the outback in Australia and a place called Wadi Rum. I don't know how you pronounce it. I'm sure if somebody speaks Arabic, they probably pronounce it differently, but that's how it's spelt. Sounds like a couple terms out of Star Wars, but it's in Jordan, the country of Jordan, in a place called the Valley of the Moon. So, literally so moon-like that they actually call it that. And it was where also they filmed Lawrence of Arabia, which was when I was a kid. That movie and I've seen that a couple times. That's a good movie. But The Martian, very realistic, which brings up a point that, if people go on space ventures and then send back imagery, the tendency of the public now is to believe that it's faked, because they can do such a good convincing job of producing this. And of course, I'm not going to mention anything about the Apollo program, because that's the only thing I'll say is, because I'm sure people are thinking that, and that might be where I'm heading with this. But in terms of any claim of people going someplace or being on Mars or moon or wherever, it requires scientific verification. Now, there are ways of doing that. For example, let's take the great explorer Vasco da Gama. That was one of my favorite explorers. And, of course, he was renowned in history and has a very special place for his tomb, etc. But he sailed around. He's a Portuguese navigator, coastal navigator. And he sailed around the tip of Good Hope, South Africa, and then up the east side of Africa, and there were two places where he went ashore and made monuments. They actually built monuments. And now I believe what you would see if you went to these places, they're actually reproductions of what he had put there. But the information and the contacts and what he brought back, etc., were, at the time, just tremendous, tremendous exploration. And in terms of time and effort and capability, would be much different than, say, going to the moon. But in terms of historical importance, you could put Vasco da Gama's explorations right up there along with, say, an effort to go to the moon. But Vasco da Gama left his marks and, he, of course, was verified and re-verified by many other people. The point is, if somebody makes a claim of some kind, then, for example, this is a great example. When Russia put up the Sputnik satellite, the very first man-made satellite, they knew that if they had something secret or something that, that only they could listen to or possibly top intelligence, U.S. intelligence could listen to, then the Western press could downplay it and say, they didn't do that. There's no proof of it. So they knew that. So what they did is they took a radio frequency, amateur radio frequency, and put a radio transmitter in Sputnik so that when it got out into space, every amateur on the planet could track it. There was no hiding this baby. And so that was a way of signaling to everybody. Anybody who knew a buddy down the street that had a ham radio could listen as Sputnik came over. And so that was a way of proving to the masses that they had in fact been the first country to put a satellite into orbit. And that was carried them far into the space race. And of course, after that, the Eisenhower, who was president at the time, really took it on the chin and never ever recovered as a popular on top of it all president. That was his kind of going out. That was his swan song, was that he did not lead the United States into military and historical prowess as being the first in outer space. And of course, the United States was only a couple months behind. And there's an interesting story about how the contract went to the Navy instead of to the Huntsville people headed by Wernher von Braun. And you can watch all that history and on TV specials, etc. Very interesting intrigue how von Braun and his people set a rocket aside, in which was very difficult to do in those days with government audits, etc. But the point is that when you make discoveries of some kind, if you're going to claim it, especially if you're a large government agency of some kind, you need third-party verification. And that's something that simply has never happened with the lunar landing. And of course, they were going to do it with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and that was a sham. They released these pictures that your cell phone could do a better job than what they released. So it was, anyway, the point is that relative to Matt Damon going to Mars, in a movie, it was very well done. And I loved the movie. I'll probably watch it again someday. But third-party verification. You have to have third-party verification. And, of course, this is one of the sticklers with the Dirty Snowball Comet model. Other countries have gone to comets. In fact, other countries were to comets. Well, no, I should say the very first country to get near a comet really close was the United States. And due to the wonderful farsightedness and progressiveness of a guy named James Farquhar, who was head of the ICE group, ISWE-3 satellite, and which was, they were running out of Goddard Space Flight Center in the high energy group at Los Alamos, who I knew pretty well, most of those people. They knew me. And in fact, were the ones responsible for me going to Los Alamos to give my talk on the plasma discharge comet model. But be that as it may, the United States was the first country to approach a comet. It was Giacobini-Zinner. No, the year was probably 1984, 1985, something like that. But then the United States did not have a plan to visit Comet Halley. And so the first real good photographs of a comet nucleus came from the Giotto spacecraft that was French. And they had wonderful close-up pictures of the nucleus of Comet Halley and showed that the nucleus was black, pitch black, much to the chagrin of NASA and Fred Whipple and the dirty snowball comet model, which was at the time the snowball comet model. It soon became the dirty snowball comet model, and then it became the dirtier than dirty snowball comet model. But anyway, with third-party verification, the end of the dirty snowball comet model should have occurred way back then in the 1980s. It actually had occurred earlier. I was making the point in the late 1979 at Cornell when I was there. I said, hey, this is not, these things are dirty snowballs. This couldn't possibly be true. And from many theoretical points of view, because you didn't have to be near a comet to understand that. But I did. But even today, they're still trying to push that narrative. Very strange, very strange. In the face of any reality at all, they're still pushing that narrative. So there's more going on there than meets the eye. So a lot of times, scientific information that you see is politically oriented. Science, politically, scientifically correct. And remember when Chuck Schrammick, I was a guest on his show a lot of times down in Houston. He was a talk show host in Houston, and he had spared no words with NASA. And, of course, NASA, Houston is a big center for NASA. Remember all of the times when the astronauts would say, Houston, we have a problem, you know, or whatever. That was where the command was for NASA. But anyway, Chuck was a talk show host in Houston, and I would be on his show quite frequently. But in fact, there's an interview on my webpage. If you dig down and go to the bottom of the historically important interviews and historically important webpages, somewhere in there is a link to the Chuck Schrammick interview. I think it's way down at the bottom. But he starts it out by saying that there is a political correctness in science. And that's something he learned from me. And, of course, he already knew it, but he just was not able to dig as deep into it as I could because I had the scientific background. I had been there. I had seen it. And not only did I discredit what they were doing, but I replaced it. And that's a big order. So anyway, back to the Matt Damon movie. I'd recommend that you see it, enjoy it, put your feet up, get your favorite beverage and sit there and watch it. And I'm sure probably most of you have already seen it. But the next time I watch, I'm going to watch more for the scenery. And that's why I like a lot of movies like, in spite of Meryl Streep, I love her movie Out of Africa. It's just the scenery. It's just so incredible. Or a lot of movies. I don't like movies that don't have scenery. You know, the city jungle type of movies. I don't like too much unless there's real acting. So anyway, okay, enough of that. I'm kind of wandering off in left field here. I got to get back to reality. The storms in the Northeast. If you watched these, you would see that these were the classic Himmokane. Now, that's a term I coined in my book, the weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, written for the general public. And the storms in the Northeast were classic Himmokanes coming across the land masses of North America. And so a lot of people up in the Northeast feeling the pinch of these big storms. And now one came in off the ocean. It came up along the Atlantic and then swung around and affected the Northeast. But the latest one, the one that's right now, people are probably buried in their house. And of course, in Minnesota, where I came from, the a foot of snow was that was just something to throw snowballs when you went to school the next day. We didn't stop for a foot of snow. We needed about 3 feet of snow before we stopped. Minnesota was very prepared, and we had those. I remember being in the 1991 blizzard, the Halloween blizzard it was called, where we had literally a hurricane come across the Canadian border states in two of them in a row. It was the leading edge and the trailing edge of the same storm, I should say, but two major snowstorms where it dumped something like 36 inches of snow one day. Then we had a beautiful, beautiful sunny day. And the next day, the trailing edge of the storm came through and dumped another 3 feet. So we had snow upon snow upon snow. And in Minnesota, if the snowplows get stuck, you know you better just stay inside. Just wait until they've laboriously get everything cleared out till you can move again, which probably says something for the sanity level of people who live in northern states. Anyway, be that as it may, I grew up there. It was a fun place to grow up, and I lived through it. I didn't even buy the T-shirt. I survived growing up in the Midwest. Another story that's we're heading into the solar minimum, which means we've hit the solar maximum. The extended magnetic field of the sun was maximum, and sunspot activity was pretty minimal, but now we're heading into a solar minimum, and that'll take the next 5.5 years or so till we actually dip down and get all the way possibly through that. But along with that, with the weakening magnetic field of the sun, comes an increase in cosmic radiation. Now, this is an interesting thing because the cosmic rays hit the atmosphere and they create what we call secondaries. Secondaries are charged particles, high energy particles that result from the initial particle coming in the atmosphere. And a lot of times the cosmic rays, which are relativistic protons or other nuclear particles coming into the Earth's atmosphere, cascade, they slow down, they interact, of course, with the atmosphere, and then there is a series of secondary radiation that comes off of this. So we're somewhat protected, but I remember the Russians, when I used to have some dealings with those guys, the scientists, they were the first ones to come out and talk about high-altitude flight. In other words, if you were a pilot, it wasn't too bad if you were a passenger because you were just up there for one flight and then you were back down on the ground. But the pilots are up there every day. Those guys are, that's their office, 35,000 feet up in the air. So the thicker part of the atmosphere, by the way, that's about 7 miles up. And if you go 1 mile up, you are at about half the atmospheric pressure of sea level. And so if you go 7 miles up, you're in fairly thin air. You're in fairly thin air. So the issue also is that cosmic rays are absorbed or they do their cascading in the thicker atmosphere. So the pilots are up there all the time. They're up there getting blasted. And so there's also measurements for people who work in outer space, astronauts and cosmonauts, and I don't know, what do the Chinese call theirs? As I recall, it's like taikonauts. But at any rate, they have to limit themselves to the number of days in space, and it's up there in the hundreds of days before they consider it a health risk But anyway, just a note, if you're feeling a little ill in the next 5 years, you could attribute it to cosmic rays. I've been talking a little bit on my paid cast, and I will be talking more about the value of things. And this brings up the topic of cryptocurrencies. So a lot of people think, computer money. How can that have value? And so I thought of another great example here that you might consider of why things have value. In other words, why would people pay money for them? Well, you can just consider artwork. Artwork is a good example where, a painting is a stretched piece of cloth, canvas, with colors on it, and some warrant, huge prices. And why is that? That's because of valuation and consensus. So let's take another example. Property that we buy. And if somebody's just looking for a place to build a house, well, any firm piece of land will do, as long as you're not hopefully in a floodplain or an earthquake zone or a tsunami zone, a volcanic eruption, downwind path, whatever, take the example of lakeshore and houses with a view, especially if it has a view of water. People, that's just like, that's magical. You stand there and you look at the water and it's beautiful. And so it gives the place value. It's not that you can build a sturdier home there. And in fact, in a lot of cases, it's not as good a site because of, say, potential for tsunamis or flooding or like the big expensive houses in California that washed off the cliff into the ocean. But there they were, right there on the edge, and they were willing to take that chance and spend big-time money to have that view. When the sun goes down in the west out of your Pacific Palisades home, well, or, wherever it was, then that had more value. So we value things, we put values on certain things, and really there's no real reason for it other than that's what we do. That's what we do. And so cryptocurrencies are the same. So if you can take something that's difficult to do, or say make a Picasso painting, that apparently is difficult to do. The abstract art gets even more difficult to judge. People have to be experts, and I'm certainly not. But it gives it value, and that's the point. So cryptocurrencies obtain their value because they're difficult to come by. And the more difficult they are to come by, the more people will pay for them. So at any rate, the other issue of cryptocurrencies that gives them value, imagine that you are a person living in the dirt in Africa, and never in your life would you have access to banking. None of your ancestors, your parents, your grandmother, grandpa, nobody you ever knew, in fact, had a bank account. You've never had access to currency. Your food, how you come by your food is by trading or being in the right place at the right time or whatever. But without money, that medium of exchange, it makes it very difficult to operate. So what if all of a sudden cryptocurrencies come along and are installed in these third world countries? And the people all of a sudden now have the ability to trade, barter, and sell their goods. And so that's one of the main things that a government is supposed to do, is to create the medium of exchange to allow the citizens to function, just like to put a highway system in. What does a highway system do? It allows people to move about. What does a telecommunication system do? it allows people to talk to each other, and that advances business, negotiations, and just this ability to speak with each other. And how about internet? The government seems to think that they can be in charge of the internet and censor everything you do. They do it on the highways. They can stop you when they want. And so there's that element of control. But the idea is that the government, one of its essential purposes, if it can stay out of the way, is to provide infrastructure so that the people can operate and manage and facilitate. You know, in the old Pony Express days, you know, you'd send a letter, you'd go down and you'd put it there, and it took 2-3 days maybe for the Pony Express guy to come by and pick up that bag of mail, and then he would ride to the next point. And the whole idea of the Pony Express was that they had a fresh horse waiting for this guy, so he'd ride until that horse was tired, leave the horse, get on another horse, ride with the mail, and then get to the destination. And that's how in the stagecoach. So a letter from Utah getting back to the folks back home in New York took weeks. And so if the news came that, you know, Uncle so-and-so died, well, there was no point in leaving New York to go out for the funeral, because it was long since passed. But communication was slow. Now it's instantaneous. Now it's voluminous. You can get, you know, hundreds of emails per day, and you can go across the country. You can get in your car and drive around, go across the country. You can go to other countries. You can fly in an airplane, rent a car, and drive around any place in the world, pretty much. And the idea is that that's what governments are supposed to do. So why does half the world not have access to banking, which is almost as essential as food and air and water? So the half of the world literally does not have access to any of those: energy, water, food, or at least good food. And of course, they're eating every day enough to, you know, not drop over from complete malnutrition. But, you know, a large percentage of the people in the world work in agriculture, and for very little. It's sustenance agriculture, and they don't have banking. So that's the banking, and the ability to have money in exchange and have a medium of exchange is essential. But the banking system has gotten so corrupted, it's not what it was supposed to be. The idea of, the term beneficiary came from banking in the early days. And the idea was that the benefactor was the person who gave the money, the person who had wealth, who had accumulated more. And the beneficiary was the person who would receive it. So that was and it was a benefit. It was a plus-plus, a win-win. So if you have, however, people living in the dirt in third world countries that have no access to banking, well, it's pretty hard to send them a bit of money so that they can get going. And so the idea is to move these economies so they have a currency exchange. And so here comes cryptocurrencies, because the bankers didn't do it. In their infinite greed, they left half of the world out. And only the people with serious amounts of money really can be in the game. I've been in third world countries where it's a strictly cash environment. If you want to go buy a car or a refrigerator, you take money, you take cash, and you'll go get it. And you make, you got to be careful nobody robs you on the way to the transaction. And you walk in and literally pay with cash. And so but once again, for most of the people in these countries, they don't have access to very much cash. There's not enough in circulation, and they, for their entire life, they don't have access to monetary exchange. But cryptocurrencies can change all of that. So now, if you can provide the poor with energy, water, and then water begets food, and it's kind of in that pecking order. Energy first, energy then allows you to generate water in some form, whether it's desalinization, whether it's putting in wells and pumping it, whether it's moving water from reservoirs or streams or seasonal runoff and storing it up or digging underwater caves. Energy is required for all of those. And if you can do it with electrical energy, then that is derived from the wind. And of course, that's not the three-blade wind generator. I have to interject that. But then if you can get water from the atmosphere, and these people can have greenhouses or fields where they use drip irrigation, and then they have food, then they have access to monetary exchange so they can improve their lives and start that economy that half of the people in the world are missing. Now, if people in the so-called first world want to do business with this growing entity of people who now can succeed, they can have things that, you know, they can go out and buy a chair, they can buy a refrigerator, they can buy food, and, you know, have access to currency. This is going to change the world that we see today. And it's something I'm talking about a lot in my paid cast. But back to the original point, value. Where does value come from? And we consider, well, an automobile, that has value. Why does it have value? Because we put value on it. If we lived in a society where, like World War II Germany, where the Volkswagen was created so there was one automobile, one design, and everybody drove that particular automobile. And so, you know, it had a state-designated value, but that's not the way we operate today. There's hundreds, probably thousands of designs of cars, different makes and models. And so some we put more value on because you get more bells and whistles, but some with the same bells and whistles cost more and other ones cost less. And why is that? Because we put value typically on quality. You're going to pay more for a higher quality unit. So, but where is the true value coming from? How come we put a value on something? There are people who are making, for example, tremendous markups on their products. It happens a lot in, the water filter business, something that I sell. And I have a set margin that I think is equitable, that's necessary for me to continue doing everything I do. But there are groups out there that charge an awful lot compared to what it costs them to produce and manufacture their products. But if people pay it, then, you know, I guess lucky them. So value has, and in fact, it's a good point that sometimes people think, well, if it costs more, it's better. That's not necessarily true. There's, for example, in the automobile industry, there are watchdog groups that test cars and rate them, and it's pretty hard to slip something by the auto industry gurus, the people that study this. It's very hard to slip something by and pretend like something's really great, and then you have Motor Trend or places that study automobiles, test them on an annual basis, and then talk about the quality of each. And the servicing is another big aspect of an automobile. Does it, after you buy it, does it require a lot of servicing? So that has value. That has value because you pay more in the beginning, but then you don't pay as much for repair. And that's a convenience because now you don't you're not without your automobile. You have less downtime. So people will pay more. So the point, I'm sorry I'm dragging this on, but we create value for all kinds of reasons. And so if you're wondering where cryptocurrency gets its value, It's simply because people will pay that. And if the value goes down, it's because people stop paying that. And it's on the open market. It's available for those that want it. If you don't want it, then you don't have to buy into it. You don't have to. Some people are in it for the short term. Some people are in for the long term. And the end result is that this is going to happen. It's going to happen because the people in the first world, or the bankers, have not allowed half of the world access to banking. And that's not going to change. You're not going to see banks opening up in Mumbai or in Kenya or Zimbabwe for the poor people. It's simply not going to happen. And so cryptocurrencies, because of this same trend, energy, water, and newer technologies are going to usher in a new era for these groups of people. But each one is very important. Energy, water, food, housing, the cryptocurrencies or some type of currency, a medium of exchange, and the list goes on. And as you cascade these solutions in front of these large numbers of people, then their life is going to improve, and that should be reflected then in poverty and in population control, which I talked about this on my paid cast once again, which everybody should be joining. But the world, about 1983, quite some time ago, I believe it was 1983, crossed the threshold for what they consider to be sustainability. In other words, after that point, we're going to use up the resources of Earth and we will not be able to sustain the population. The other thing I looked at was very interesting, and that is the charts, the energy charts and estimates. Now, this is not peak oil type of scare tactics or whatever, but realistic estimates of the oil, coal, and nuclear energy that's available. And the United States now is running low on nuclear energy. And that's, of course, one of the, it's bizarre, I don't know what other word to use, trades that was made to give Russia 20% of our uranium when we're short on it, a critical supply for military and for our own economy. So why would anybody cut a deal with our main, if you want to call them, rival on the planet, Russia, to give them 20% of our uranium? And even if we stop using it in nuclear power plants, it's still a critical element it's a critical element in the political world, of science and engineering and military. So unfortunately, we still live in that nuclear age. We live in the jet age, in the, they might even say someday we're living in the cryptocurrency age. Or they might say someday that we're living in the McCanny wing generator, the jet age of wind power. So they put terms because of major events that came along in history, and like the nuclear age, the jet age, or whatever. And we're about to see some of these major civilization-changing events coming along very soon. Okay, well, enough of that. So just a little expose on why cryptocurrencies have value. And and it's going to force the first world countries, once the momentum is there for the third world countries with cryptocurrencies, if the first world countries want to trade with them, it's going to establish a trade between dollars and euros and ruples and pounds or whatever, and the cryptocurrencies. And it's hard to say. There's every day there's another cryptocurrency coming out, so it's hard to say where this is all going to shake out. Who are going to be the winners? Who are going to be the losers? And it's almost to the point now A friend of mine said the other day, it's almost like the, remember the web businesses, the dot-com era, where people were creating businesses out of thin air, only to have them shut down within 6 months and not go anyplace. But there were, that was the rage. People put value on it. People invested. And people eventually lost their shirts in it, some people. And other people, it came and went, and it never affected them at all, like me. I had, I would say the dot-com era had zero effect on me other than I had to listen to it and listen to people talking about it. And so that brings me to the main science topic tonight, which is I'm going to be talking about the WING project, which I hope you know about. If you don't, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, scroll down on the left-hand side. You'll find the video. It looks the Tesla Roadster is on the cover of this. And by the way, the processing company that did that put that there, that was not my choice. That was selected for me by the format. And so anyway, that's why I would have rather had a picture of the WING generator, not a Tesla. It's not about Tesla automobiles, although I mention them as being an integral part of what's going on today. But the term I want you to pay attention to is the term World Energy Water Project. Now, I started this actually many years ago. And it's come a long way, let me just put it that way, in some new twists and turns. But when I pick something to work on, especially I'm not getting any younger. I still feel excellent. I think I'm in excellent health. I try and live a very clean lifestyle and all of that. Looking back on my own history as an independent scientist, when I pick something to work on and spend my valuable time on this planet working on it and my creativity and my God-given talents and I'm moving something forward, I pick something that I think is really important. And if you watch my video, I start out by listing 10 things, the 10 biggest problems in the world, and the very first two are energy and water. So when I picked the name World Energy Water Project, it's because I understand that solving these two problems is paramount to the world getting its act together. Without that, we're going to be stuck in this pit of energy usage. I just saw an article, they were talking about Beijing. They said one day in Beijing is equivalent to breathing in or smoking 4 packs of cigarettes. If I smoked 4 packs of cigarettes, that'd be the end. I couldn't even imagine smoking one cigarette or even taking a puff of one. Just a funny story. When I was a kid, in fact, I never smoked throughout my life. But when I was a kid in probably about fourth or fifth grade, something like that, I'm walking home from school with a friend of mine that lived a little farther away than I did. And so we're walking. He says, come on, we're going to go. And he had a cigarette. He had stolen a cigarette from his mom. So anyway, we go kind of behind this garage on the way home from school, and he lights it up, and he says, here, take a puff. And I looked at it, and I go, okay. My dad smoked at that time. He quit. But I took one puff in, and it came out faster than it went in. I mean, it was just, it was just like terrible. It was like, why would you do this? And I turned green, literally, like in the cartoons when you turn green. And I was like, okay, that's, I don't need any more of that. So I never in my whole life smoked. But anyway, the idea is that can you imagine smoking 4 packs of cigarettes by just spending a day in Beijing? I was like, ooh, wow, that's I better plan on what I'm going to do if I ever go to Beijing. But I was just mentioning about the longevity, the lifetime of coal, nuclear, and oil. And coal is the one that we probably have the most availability. And at the rate we're using it, we would use up the known reserves of coal by the year 2088, this chart said. And nuclear would be somewhere about the middle of this century, and oil would be much sooner, around 2045, is when we would start getting to the point where we were using up all this oil. But the question is, can we burn all this? The Orinoco Valley in Venezuela, they claim has nearly an infinite amount of tar oil, and it's available, and they can convert it into gasoline, and they claim that it will last, you know, nearly forever. I don't know. But the point is, we got to stop doing this. And I raised a criticize the other day, talking about, I was on an interview with it was the first time I was on this show, John Ferguson. You should listen to that show. He has a podcast. It's called Technology and Change. Look it up. I was a guest and this past week, and it's a podcast. We went for about 90-minute interview. But look that up, because it was a very good interview. It covered a lot of ground, including energy and cryptocurrencies and some of the modern issues dealing with replacing centralized power. Okay, so anyway. But the point is, we just can't keep burning oil and coal and nuclear fuel. It's just not an option. So what I've felt is that people have a feeling of desperation. And I, by the way, criticized the tree huggers, of which I'm one. I'm a tree hugger. I'm not a global climate change tree hugger. But I criticize them for the fact that, at least if they still believe in global warming, which is, you know, it's like a religion, because when you say, I believe, that takes it out of the realm of science. There's no science in I believe, you know, that's a religion. You believe, that's a religion. You have proved it in with scientific cause and effect, that's science. So if people go, I believe, well, you just stepped out of the world of science and into the world of religion. So if you still believe in global climate change, that's fine. But the point is, over the past 30 years that this has been going on, have they really accomplished anything? Has it reduced emissions? Has it reduced our dependency on high energy content fuels? And the answer is, well, obviously no. Because if you look at the accords, they say something like, well, and by the year 2050, we're going to reduce 50% of emissions. Well, that doesn't even mean anything. There's absolutely no meaning. There's no teeth. There's no plan to get there. There's no immediate plan. And so it's just like politicians being politicians. Yeah. So the point is that if you believe in global climate change, your narrative has done nothing. The true narrative that all of us should be talking about is, hey, we just can't do this anymore. But the problem is, we're addicted to energy, and up till now, there's been no solution. Actually, my solution, the wing generator, has been around for quite a long time. It's now being released after many long uphill battles that I had to go through personally. But the issue is that there is a sense, and this is something I see now very clearly, that there is a sense of urgency that exists today that did not exist 2 years ago. That even a year ago, there was not a sense of urgency. Today I was talking to a friend and said that he had read an article recently that Maine has finally woken up to the fact that their offshore wind farms of three-blade wind generators don't work. So isn't that amazing? After all the hype and the excitement and you know, the legal loopholes and everything that had to happen, and the subsidies and the tax incentives and everything else that had to happen, that the they discover that these things don't work, and it's being discovered all over the world. But anyway, I'm not going to talk about the myth of alternative energy now. You can read about that in my book, The McCanny Wing Generator. The issue is that we just can't continue burning high energy content fuels. So when I talk about the World Energy Water Project and the fact that we can, that when we obtain water from whatever source it is, and I'll just list a few, moving it from, say, an iceberg, moving an iceberg up to some location, taking water that's during the melts of the northern summer or the southern summer or the northern summer with Greenland, etc., taking that melted water, which is pristine, pure water, 95% of the world fresh water locked up in those ice caps, and it's melting, pouring into the ocean, and all we have to do is just put it in something and take it somewhere. The movement of those of the water would be accomplished also by the wing generator or the spring runoff from the Missouri and Mississippi rivers to put that out into the American Southwest, where they're, by the way, having severe drought right now in spite of the flooding and the huge rains that they're having in California. There's other parts of the American Southwest that are in severe flood, like Arizona, for example. So, but the wing generator can move water. So energy, if you have energy at low price, then you can get water. Desalinization, atmospheric water generators, underground wells, pumping water from reservoirs that are full and moving them to other parts of the country. All of these methods of moving water require energy. So energy is the key to everything. It's like the, if you can do energy, then you get water. If you have water, then you get food. If you have food, then you have good health. You have nutrition. You bring an end to the poverty cycle where people now have a decent lifestyle. You also have materials that you can use to build housing because you're well fed, you have water, you have chickens and cows and other farm animals that give you other products that are necessary for a balanced diet, and unless you're a vegetarian, and it just goes right down the list. All of the problems in the world start with energy. In fact, starvation, you could make a good case, if we could take and divert the time, money, and resources that we put into energy, procuring them, etc. And by the way, my paid cast for this week and the next 2 weeks deal with the exposing, which many people don't understand, the extensive amount of time and energy, etc., it takes to get coal. This week I'm talking about coal. This is in the paid cast. Next week I'll be talking about nuclear. In the next week in March, I will be talking about petroleum. So all of the effort that goes in to procuring the energy that you use and flaunt every day, this is very important. So if you can cure energy, if you can take that and knock it down to size, then all of a sudden that money is freed up. That's like having, that's better than a tax break. Because a tax break can come and go, but if you can take the top two-thirds off of the energy requirement in terms of cost for businesses, etc., all of a sudden, that's an enormous amount of money that then can go, that would lower food prices, that would lower prices in general, and it would, the effect on the world economically would be far better than a tax break. What does a tax break do? And this is something three presidents understood: Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and current President Trump. Understand the value of tax reducing the tax rate. And of course, Reagan threw in Star Wars, which, you know, we're still paying for. But the idea is that now people have more money to spend. It's the velocity of money. It's not people saving money in the bank. That's not a indicator of value in a society. In fact, that's an indicator that you've lost your values. The indicator of a healthy economic society is one in which the velocity of money is maxed out. And once that velocity of money occurs, then money is passing through your hand at a much faster rate. And every time it passes through a hand, somebody, if you're a good business person, you are extracting some of that money. And if you're the government, you're taxing a little piece of that money. So the velocity of money is very important. And so as much as I despise Bill Clinton, he knew that. He understood that, and he had the national debt almost paid off. And then, well, the rest is history. Now we're how many trillions of dollars in debt? But, you know, be that as it may. But conquering, like I say, when I go after a problem, it's because I realize, like the calculate primes problem, I worked on that problem all my life, and I finally cracked it. Because I knew that that was the central core problem of mathematics. It was the oldest mathematical problem, and it had ramifications in cryptography, in secure computing, in telecommunications. I knew that that was a very important problem to work on. So I didn't just haphazardly decide to work on that problem. It was the most important problem in all of mathematics. So energy is the most important. If you can cure energy, then you have water. If you have water, then you have food. If you have food, then you get rid of poverty and starvation, and you can end and cut into that poverty cycle. And from there on, okay, the disgruntled people in the world, if they have something to do, if they're well-fed, it's going to change the face of the world. So that's why I worked on that problem. That's why I created a solution, the wing generator, and this is coming along now. So I tell you, I can't talk about all the things that are going on in the background, but very essential, many essential things are happening. And so if you want to know more about that, like I say, go look at the video on my webpage. But when I define this as the World Energy Water Project, that's what it's all about, because it is the most important thing that we can do right now is solve that problem. So just quickly, I didn't talk much about my water filters. Still 15% sale. I have not had time to go in there and take that down. So if you're looking at buying the replacement water filter elements, etc., 15% off, still 30% off on the whole house filters. Great reduction in price on the replacement packs. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.